Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Plain Error and Appellate Review Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 20th, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Henderson v. United States. The question in the case is whether or not, when a criminal defendant's sentence is plainly erroneous in light of an intervening Supreme Court decision, the plain error correction is prohibited under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 52B, because the law was unsettled when the district court imposed the sentence and the defendant failed to object. In a 6-3 decision delivered by Justice Breyer, the court held that regardless of whether a legal question was settled or unsettled at the time of trial, an error is plain within the meaning of Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 52B, so long as the error was plain at the time of appellate review. The decision of the Fifth Circuit was reversed and the case was remanded for further proceedings. Chief Justice Roberts, as well as Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and Kennedy joined the opinion of the court. Justice Scalia filed a dissenting opinion, which Justices Thomas and Alito joined. To discuss the case, we have Elizabeth Lopez, a partner at Winston & Strawn. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Ms. Lopez.
This is Elizabeth Lopez from Winston & Strawn to discuss the Supreme Court's 2013 opinion in case number 119307, Henderson versus United States. Notwithstanding the argument and opinion references to unicorns and hippogriffs, the decision is about a relatively narrow issue of criminal procedure, namely when a federal appellate court can correct a legal error that a defendant failed to raise at trial. That issue is governed by Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 52, which says that appellate courts can correct, quote, plain errors that were not raised at trial, but does not say whether the error must be plain at the time the defendant failed to raise it, or if it's good enough that the error is plain by the time the defendant's case is on appeal. The headline and ruling is that the court decided 6-3 that appellate courts can correct errors that are plain at the time of appeal, even if the law or basis for error was unsettled at trial, and the defendant thus arguably should have objected to the error in the district court. Justice Breyer authored the 13-page majority opinion, and Justice Scalia wrote a pointed 10-page dissent joined by Justices Thomas and Alito. The opinion is significant in two respects. First, it brings some clarity and, in the majority's view, fairness of result to appellate review of legal errors in criminal cases. Second, it provides a window into how different members of the court deal with the interaction between legal text, precedent, and extratextual policy and fairness concerns. These differences in approach are not new or surprising, but the argument and opinions in this case provided an interesting stage for them to play out. Just some quick background before getting into the opinion. The case itself arose out of the Fifth Circuit's refusal to correct an error in a Texas district court sentencing of petitioner Amarcion Henderson. Henderson, a 26-year-old with prior criminal history, pled guilty to a single count of being a felon in possession of a firearm that carried a sentence 33 to 41 months under the federal sentencing guidelines. Neither his lawyer nor the prosecution disputed that sentencing range, but his defense counsel urged the court to order drug treatment counseling as part of Henderson's sentence. The court did so, but to accommodate Bureau of Prisons requirements for program treatment length, imposed an above-guideline sentence of 60 months imprisonment. In short, the district court extended Henderson's criminal sentence above his guidelines range to qualify him for the drug treatment his lawyer requested. At the time the court entered the sentence, neither Henderson's lawyer nor the prosecution raised federal statutory provision 18 U.S.C. 3582A, which says that, quote, imprisonment is not an appropriate means of promoting correction and rehabilitation. 8 days after the district court entered Henderson's sentence, his counsel did file a motion noting the statute and asking the court to reduce the 60-month sentence as a clear error. But the district court refused to grant the motion for jurisdictional reasons, so Henderson took the issue up on appeal in the Fifth Circuit. The issue before the Court of Appeals is whether it could correct the sentencing error under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 52B, which says that a, quote, plain error that affects substantial rights may be considered even though it was not brought to the court's attention, end of quote. Obviously, this was a case where Henderson's lawyer did try to raise it, so it wasn't maybe the perfect vehicle for saying that the error was not raised below, but the district court's decision that it did not have jurisdiction to consider it put Henderson in the position of arguing that really this was a 52B situation of unpreserved or unexamined trial court error below, and he argued that to the extent the district court's error of extending his sentence for rehabilitative purposes was not plain at the time of trial, it certainly was plain error on appeal because the Supreme Court had, in the intervening time, decided a case holding that extending sentences for rehabilitation purposes was improper and, in fact, statutorily prohibited. So Henderson argued that the error was plain at the time of appeal and clearly affected his substantial rights by subjecting him to an additional 27 months in prison and therefore was a fair candidate for Rule 52B relief. The Fifth Circuit disagreed. It held that his sentence was erroneous, but that Rule 52B did not allow relief because the error was not plain when it was made at trial, as evidenced by the fact that the Supreme Court had to issue a subsequent ruling clarifying the matter. The U.S. Supreme Court granted review of the Fifth Circuit's decision to decide whether the plain error rule applies when the law in a circuit is unsettled at the time a trial court error is committed, but later becomes clear at the time of appeal. The issue was one that the Supreme Court had recognized but declined to decide in two prior cases. In U.S. versus Olano and Johnson versus U.S., the court noted but did not decide the question whether Rule 52B applies to unpreserved errors made when circuit law on the question and issue is unclear. Henderson and his amici argued that the rule's text, history, and purpose required courts of appeals to provide relief to errors that are plain at the time of appeal, regardless of the state of the law when the trial court committed the error and the defendant failed to object. The government argued the exact opposite and urged the court to hold that the error must have been plain at the time of trial for the rule to apply. The issue that ultimately divided the parties and the court was whether interpreting the rule to allow for appellate correction of errors that were plain on appeal but unclear at trial could be reconciled with the general principle, embodied also in the federal rules, that a party forfeits his right to assert a trial court error if he fails to raise it for the trial court's consideration in the first instance. The six-justice majority opinion began by recognizing that appellate error correction under Rule 52B is an exception to the, quote, normal rule that a federal appellate court will, quote, not correct a legal error made in criminal trial court unless the defendant first brought the error to the trial court's attention. But the majority noted that the text of Rule 52B leaves open the, quote, temporal question of whether errors that fall within its purview must be plain at the time of trial or at the time of appellate review. It held that competing lines of authority provided some support for both positions. The majority recognized that the government's time of trial rule was supported by the general waiver principle, the court's decision in Olano limiting Rule 52B error correction to a relatively narrow set of circumstances, and the court's decision in Johnson recognizing the rule's application to unpreserved errors that were plain at the time of appeal, but at the time of trial were so clearly authorized by precedent that an objection would have been futile. The majority ultimately concluded, however, that Henderson's time of appeal approach was the right one because it was more consistent with the text of the rule and the principle that appellate courts apply the law in effect at the time of appeal when they review issues. Further, and perhaps most importantly, the majority concluded that the tiebreaker was that Henderson's approach, as opposed to the government's, would avoid the anomaly and unfairness of denying correction of a plain error on appeal simply because the law at trial was unsettled as opposed to clearly favorable or unfavorable to the defendant at the time of trial. In sum, the majority concluded that although the relevant rule's text, precedents, and background principles did not directly dictate the result in the case, The time of appeal rule was the proper interpretation because it would avoid the, quote, highly and unfairly anomalous result that Rule 52B error correction is available when the state of law at trial is either clearly favorable to the defendant or clearly unfavorable, but not somewhere in the middle. The majority answered the dissent's concerns about its approach, and specifically about allegedly abandoning the text of the rule and the waiver principle, with 2 points. First, the majority said that Olano's limitation of Rule 52B correction to errors that substantially affect the case would prevent the court's ruling from, quote, opening the plain error floodgates in federal appeals. Second, the majority said that the rule was unlikely to disincent lawyers from raising available and timely objections at trial, which was one of the dissent's main concerns. The majority based this conclusion on the fact that lawyers at trial have many reasons to raise timely objections where possible, and that relying on Rule 52B correction is a dicey proposition because of all the limitations imposed by the rule itself and the court's precedents. As the majority put it, quote, if there is a lawyer who would deliberately forego objection now because he perceives some slightly expanded chance to argue for plain error later, we suspect that, like the unicorn, that lawyer finds his home in the imagination, not in the courtroom. The dissent did not mince words. It began by stating that the majority's approach, quote, disregards the importance of claim preservation and deprives Rule 52B's plainless limitation of all conceivable purpose. It then attacked the majority's entire analysis as, quote, misconceiving the court's task as examining, quote, competing legal principles to determine, quote, where justice lies, rather than engaging in the more, quote, mundane and lawyerly task of interpreting the relevant rule. On that score, the dissent concluded that the answer must be sought, and in fact lies in, the text of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. The dissent explained that the plain error provisions of Rule 52B must be read in context as an exception to the error preservation requirements set forth in Rule 51B, and that where one reads the two rules together, Rule 52B must be read in a way that does not, quote, thwart the preservation rule in 51. The dissent then concluded that the government's time of trial rule is the only reading of Rule 52B's plainness requirement that does not thwart the preservation requirements in Rule 51B, because where an error is plain at trial, or where, as in Johnson, it would be futile to raise the error against settled circuit law, appellate correction of the error does not improperly reward defendants who violate Rule 51 by failing to raise and preserve their errors. The dissent pointedly criticized the majority for failing to articulate any such purpose for a plainness requirement at the time of appeal, and thus for failing to reconcile the rule's text with their conclusion and interpretation. The dissent further dismissed the majority's three-defendant example of the unfair application of the government's time of trial rule as misapprehending the sense in which the three defendants in the majority example were, quote, similarly situated. The dissent pointed out that the majority's focus was on whether all three defendants were prejudiced by unpreserved trial error, but the dissent emphasized that that is not the point for Rule 52B purposes. The point for Rule 52B is whether they were similarly situated from the standpoint of their obligation to raise and preserve their trial errors. The dissent said the defendants who failed to object to trial errors that were either plain under circuit law or foreclosed by such law at the time of trial did not have the same duty to raise and preserve the error as the defendant who faced the error under circuit law that was unsettled, and therefore would have allowed for a trial court ruling in his favor had he timely raised the issue. Having made these points, the dissent turned to chopping away at the majority's conclusion that a lawyer would not likely forego a timely trial objection in favor of asserting plain error on appeal later. The dissent chided Justice Breyer for, quote, indulging this, quote, delusion, despite joining prior opinions recognizing that counsel have both the ability and incentive to, quote, sandbag a trial court by, quote, remaining silent about objections and belatedly pursuing them only if the case does not break their way. The dissent also dismissed as a, quote, Pollyannish rejoinder to serious claim preservation concerns the majority's conclusion that Olano's requirements for Rule 52B relief would serve as an adequate backstop against a new flood of plain error reversals on appeal, emphasizing that cabining such review would not be nearly as easy as the majority imagined. The dissent concluded that the court's ruling, quote, transformed Rule 52B into, quote, an end run around the consequences of claim forfeiture. For those following the case, I think a majority in dissent pitting Justice Breyer's principles-based approach to the interpretive question and issue against Justice Scalia's more formal textualist approach was no great surprise, nor was the fact that Justices Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan sided with Justice Breyer, whereas Justices Thomas and Alito joined Justice Scalia's dissent. That Justice Kennedy, and particularly the Chief Justice, joined the majority was perhaps less predictable based on the questions they asked at argument, and what I view as the majority's failure to really engage, much less refute, the dissent's Rule 51 analysis. Whether the majority's decision will burden federal appellate courts with significantly more plain error appeals remains to be seen. I think if Justice Scalia is correct, the ruling will permit more gamesmanship, if not just simple sloppiness at trial, without penalty of the forfeiture rule and its resultant limitations on appellate review. And I also think, regardless whether the ruling significantly affects the nature and number of criminal appeals in the near term, it'll be interesting to see if the Chief Justice and Justice Kennedy, who joined the majority here, would also be willing to really, it seems, subordinate arguments about a governing provision's text and context to the more generic precedential and fairness concerns that animate the Henderson majority. That approach could have significant consequences for industries regulated by federal statutes and administrative agency rules, and I think a trend toward increasing or preserving avenues to judicial review of legal rights would be consistent with several of the court's decisions during the Chief Justice's tenure in various areas. So I think beyond the obvious and immediate consequences of the criminal procedure ruling, it'll be interesting to see whether the Chief Justice's position in this case and Justice Kennedy's will be echoed in future decisions where they may affect rights to judicial review under federal agency or other statutory regimes.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.